You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. My guest, Mallory O'Meara, is a filmmaker, a podcaster, and the author of one of the best film history books I've ever read. That book is called The Lady from the Black Lagoon: Hollywood Monsters and the Lost Legacy of Millicent Patrick. The book was published in 2019, but I just discovered it, and I invited the author to talk with us about it today. Mallory O'Meara, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Gary, thank you so much for having me on.
You know, in the first 5 minutes or so of Orson Welles' Citizen Kane, we learned basically the whole story of Kane that we're about to see. And then the rest of the film, you know, kind of retells the story in detail. And your book, The Lady from the Black Lagoon, Hollywood Monsters and the Lost Legacy of Millicent Patrick, it does almost the same thing. So can you share with us, as you did in the first few sentences of your book, you know, the basic story of Millicent Patrick?
I always like to call Millicent Patrick the Forrest Gump of the 1950s because she had quite a over-the-top, incredible life. But what she is most well-known for is she designed the creature from the Black Lagoon. But we don't know her very well. I mean, hopefully my book has changed that. But she's gone unknown for so many decades because her creation and the legacy and the legacy is the right way to put it, was stolen from her by someone who worked at the creature shop at the Universal Studio makeup department. And it was quite a tale of what happened to her.
And so how did you, you know, most biographies are the subject of the biography and of the, you know, of the person and less about the biographer. But your stories are so intertwined in this book. So how did that come about that you're telling not just her story, but your own?
Yeah, the book is sort of ends up being like Julie and Julia, and it did not start out that way. I had always wanted to tell Millicent's story. I'm a huge Creature from the Black Lagoon fan, and I really wanted to know what happened to this woman who created it and designed it. And in preparation for the book, I had read all of these biographies of people that I know and I care about. And I read, or rather listened to, the very, very long audiobook of Ruth Franklin's A Rather Haunted Life about Shirley Jackson, who's my favorite author. And it's an incredible biography. It's massively detailed. And by the end of it, you know what kind of snacks that Shirley Jackson liked and, you know, what her favorite house dress was. And I thought, wow, this is great. But I can't do that, because the reason I care about Shirley Jackson's favorite house dress is because I'm obsessed with Shirley Jackson. I'm already there for it. I'm ready to absorb any and all facts about her. But I, with Millicent Patrick, I had to make people care about someone that they had never even heard of. And I realized that the best way for me to get people to care about her is to show people why I care about her. And so our story, I started, you know, writing it in that way. And the introduction to the book is about why she matters so much to me. But the thing is, I work as a film producer. I work in the same industry that she did just 60 years later. And I wanted to show that, you know, it's so easy to go, oh, well, you know, this woman had her credit for this creation stolen from her. But that was back in the 1950s. You know, things aren't like that anymore. But the truth is that they are. And I had experienced some of the same things that Millicent went through. So I wanted to show people, look, this stuff is still happening. It's happening to me. It's you can't argue with it. So the book sort of developed from there. And also, I'm a huge research nerd, and I thought, what better way to show people how she had been purposely buried than to take readers along on the journey of unearthing her legacy?
There was another kind of Citizen Kane moment in your book when I think of you in the room looking through all of these records. It's just like the scene where, you know, he's looking at Thatcher's notebook and then someone is watching him the whole time. You did that kind of research for this book.
Oh yeah, I'm a huge, huge, huge research nerd. As a nonfiction writer, I sort of have to be, and that part to me is so exciting. I wanted to show folks how exciting that research can be. And the funny part about the Citizen Kane analogy is that Millicent herself had a very close connection with Citizen Kane. Citizen Kane, the story of that was based off of the life of William Randolph Hearst, on whose summer home Millicent grew up at.
Right, she grew up at the her father worked on the castle. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, when I found out that Millicent Patrick grew up at Hearst Castle, it's like, you know, it's the kind of thing that as a nonfiction writer, you wish you could make up. Like you could, like so much about Millicent Patrick's life was so over the top. And I just couldn't even believe that one person had lived in all of these places and all of these interesting moments with all these interesting people there. Her father was the structural engineer for William Randolph Hearst's, I say summer home, but when I say that, you know, you're thinking of a cute house on the beach, but this was a massive, massive estate, which is now a state park here in Southern California. And so that's where she grew up. And where else could she go after that but Hollywood?
And she worked at Disney. She was an animator for Walt Disney.
Yes, that was her first job. It was her first job right out of art school was working at the Disney Animation Studio.
Where did she go to art school?
At the Chouinard Institute in Los Angeles, which is a really, really special, that's something else that I wanted to highlight a little bit in the book, is that a lot of the people that Millicent Patrick interacted with were very, very fascinating in their own way, hence the Forrest Gump analogy. And the woman who ran the Chouinard Institute was a woman named Melbert Chouinard, and she was very, very singular. It was very, very rare for a woman to run an art institute anywhere in the country at this time. But she was very singular because she had formed this great relationship with Walt Disney. And at the time, Walt Disney didn't have, I mean, now we think of, you know, this gargantuan corporate giant who soon will own all movie studios and Disney is just gobbling everything up. But back then, Walt Disney didn't even have the money to pay to have his animators trained in the way that he knew that they needed to be. And he had been asking around at all these different art schools for help. And Melbert Chouinard was the only one who said, okay, great. You can't pay me now, but we'll figure something out. Let's do it. And so a pipeline began to form between the animators who were being trained at Disney or at Chouinard and Disney Studios, and Disney would, you know, drive his animators there himself. And he would hang out there at the Art Institute and see what folks were doing. And he sort of had his pick of the talent there, because who wouldn't want to be working at Disney Studios even then? And that's how he met Millicent.
And so many of the animators that worked at Disney then went on to be animators at other studios too. So that was like a chain.
Yeah, it's a really special little place and time in animation and in film history. Is this, you know, film is such a weirdly small world, even though it feels very large. And it's really cool to see that Millicent was there in this moment when all of these connections were being forged.
Well, for a long time, I had thought that there weren't female animators, that the females worked downstairs in the Hyperion Disney studio, and they were like the, you know, they did other work other than animating, and then the animators were all the men who were upstairs. But that's not true, I guess.
No, not at all. And that was, I mean, it was a huge surprise for me as well. And I was very, very lucky to be working on Lady from the Black Lagoon at the same time that my friend Mindy Johnson was working on her book, Ink and Paint, which is about the history of women in Disney animation. And it was sort of a magical, you got your chocolate and my peanut butter, I got my peanut butter and your chocolate moment, where I didn't know anything about what Millicent did at Disney other than the fact that she worked there. And Mindy didn't know anything about Millicent's personal life other than she worked at Disney. So we kind of got together and Mindy was able to share all this incredible information about the massive amount of women that were working there at the time. In fact, of all the animation studios, it was Disney who had the most women.
I love Mindy Johnson's book, and she was here on From the Bookshelf talking about it a couple of years ago. So what exactly did Millicent Patrick do when she was working for Disney?
Well, she started out in the ink and paint department, which is really the focus of Mindy's book, that there was this massive department of only women who inked and painted all of the animators' drawings onto the cells that were going to be filmed to create the movies. But she was so talented, and so she got moved up and sort of moved up along the line of the animation pipeline to being a special effects artist. And I won't say, it's sort of a big reveal in the book what movie she worked on, because it's very important to me. So I won't say what project that was for folks who haven't read it yet. But she started working in the special effects department. And that's where, and she moved up from there to animation. It was just a natural progression for her. Millicent had a really, really incredible ability to convey a lot of movement and a lot of emotion in just a few lines, which is, you know, magic for an animator.
And she was also an actress. I mean, she was very beautiful.
Yes, she was everything. It was incredible. She did it all. She was an animator. She was an artist. She was an illustrator. She was a model. She was an actress. And that's where she went after Disney, is she started modeling, and then she was discovered, as it happens, in Los Angeles, and became an actress.
And did she ever come back to animation, or that was it for her as an animator?
That was it for her. She never came back to animation, but she continued working in art for the rest of her life.
And did she encounter the kind of sexism that she encountered at Universal Studios when she was at Disney?
It's hard to say. It's less publicized. There's a really great famous memo that Walt Disney released to all of the employees about the ink and paint department, that, you know, men were encouraged to leave the women alone. So there definitely was an air of, this is a place of business, please let these ladies work. But, you know, it's almost, women know the myriad ways that people can, that misogyny and sexism can sort of worm their way into everyday scenarios. So I can't speak to how the working conditions were, but I would consider, especially at the start of Millicent's career at Disney, her working in a room full of 100% exclusively women, that things were pretty good for her.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. We're talking this week with Mallory O'Meara. She's a film producer, and she's written a book called The Lady from the Black Lagoon, Hollywood Monsters, and the Lost Legacy of Millicent Patrick. Before the break, Mallory O'Meara was telling us about Millicent Patrick's time as a animator for Walt Disney Studios. She was one of the first female animators there, if not the first. So, Mallory O'Meara, tell us, how did Millicent Patrick come to be employed at the makeup department under Bud Westmore at Universal Studios in Hollywood?
Well, she was working at Universal as a background actress, and one of her pastime, if you've ever been on a film set, you know that there's a lot of downtime, especially if you are an actor. So while she was in between takes, in between makeup chair sittings, her favorite hobby was sketching portraits of her co-stars. She was very, very, very talented at portraits and human faces, and she was at Universal, and she was in the makeup chair and waiting around, and came across Bud Westmore, who was the man who ran the makeup department at Universal. And she showed him those portraits and sketches, and he said, oh my God, like, she was just so wildly talented. And he hired her to be a designer in the makeup department.
And everything went well.
Well, it was, at first, it wasn't an immediate jump into Monsters. The really exciting thing about the time that Millicent was hired, which was about 1952, is that this was a time period that a lot of things were changing in film. Things were slowly moving from black and white over to color. In the horror world, we were basically moving from being afraid of your old world European things to being afraid of the sky. This was when science fiction was developing. It was a new genre. There was all, you know, science itself was booming. Interest in space was booming. There was a lot of things going on, and everyone wanted to get in on it. And lastly, there was a new audience that no one had ever thought to cater to before, and that was teenagers. You know, up until that point, it wasn't really an audience that filmmakers really thought too much about. But all of a sudden, you had all these suburban teenagers who had pocket money and time to go to the movie theater. So studios were starting to scramble. They wanted to make science fiction films. And they needed to compete with television for the first time in history. So they wanted these really fun films that appealed to a lot of different people, would get teenagers there, would get people moving from the living room back into the movie theater. And, you know, so Millicent's first few films were just dramas and actions and comedies. And then Universal thought, you know what, we really want to get into this world of sci-fi. And they hired a very well-known author now, Ray Bradbury, to make a treatment for a movie called It Came From Outer Space. And that was Universal's first science fiction film. And Millicent was working in the makeup room at the time. And Bud Westmore said, hey, you know what, you've been designing makeups for pirates and beautiful women. How about creating an alien monster for me? And she took Ray Bradbury's description, which was very vague, to say the least. And she came up with all these different designs, and eventually they settled on one of them and made it into the film. And, you know, today we look at it and it still looks very cheesy. Cheesy's the perfect word for it. But in 1952, that was terrifying, absolutely terrifying. And the film was a success. It didn't make a ton of money, but it definitely was a success. And Universal said, man, we need more of these sci-fi movies. So Bud Westmore said, let's do it again, Milson. She was in as the monster designer.
So it came from outer space. That was a great big eyeball with a, it's hard to even describe what that monster looked like.
Well, and the funny part is, I mean, that's what Ray Bradbury intended. I mean, one of the words used in the description of it was nebulous. You know, it was a great big paragraph of a description that poor Millicent was tasked with sort of realizing. And now it sort of, it looks like an eyeball and like a sandwich baggie with weird little arms. But the, you know, again, to a teenager in the 50s, that was absolutely horrifying.
One of the best things about that monster in that movie, and I think that that's the kind of what makes good monsters, is that you don't ever really get a good look at it. And for the whole first two-thirds of the movie, you don't see it at all, which is kind of like Alien or some other great monsters.
Yes, because up until that point, until like the last part of the movie, you have so much anticipation built over what this monster looks like that by the time you see it in not great light, and again, it was still black and white at the time, it feels a lot more terrifying than it really is. If you had put that monster, you know, in a Starbucks and at noon, he would be kind of funny looking.
Well, especially when you see it, it's scary when you see it through the eyes of the leading lady who's staring at it and screaming, and it's kind of on her face, and it's...
Yes, and it's coming at her. I mean, it really, as silly as it can be, it is very effective, and that is something, a hallmark of Millicent Patrick's work, is always extremely, extremely effective. And I mean, it's still a classic movie. It holds the test of time. I think it's still in one of the American Film Institute's most important science fiction films.
I think it's a good film. I mean, I didn't see it when it first came out, but I was a little kid when I saw it, and I didn't question it. I didn't think it was cheesy. I thought it was scary.
Yes, absolutely. I absolutely love it. I'm clearly very biased about all of Millicent's work, but I do really love that movie.
And so was the next thing she did the creature, or she did the other monsters?
Well, she was working on a bunch of things at once, but the next big thing was Creature from the Black Lagoon. And the funny part is that the makeup department were not even the ones who were supposed to be creating the creature. The funny thing about special effects work and creature design is it falls into a very interesting place in film, because it's not quite a prop, but it's not quite all an actor, and it's not quite a costume. And so it's this sort of strange in-between place. And when Universal decided they wanted to do this film, which wasn't called Creature from the Black Lagoon until after it had really already been shot, they originally had the prop department put it together, and it was a complete disaster. And it wasn't until they realized that what the prop department had created was not going to work that they should ask the effects department and the makeup folks. And the creature is very singular in the way that he, of all the Universal monsters, he's really the only complete monster. He's a full suit. You know, he's not just a head and hands or a makeup and hands.
His feet and everything.
Oh yeah. It was something that hadn't really been done before.
I think that's why not only is the movie so popular, but when I was a kid, there was an Aurora model kit, and there were always dolls, and, you know, I mean, the entire creature was something to behold.
Yes, absolutely.
And so she drew it. What did she do exactly?
So she sketched it out. She came, her and Bud Westmore worked on a few different designs. Bud had some ideas, but they were sort of sidelined because they just weren't good ideas. And the thing that gives the creature its power is that Millicent actually did a lot of research. She really understood that with science fiction, unlike straight horror, you know, there has to be a scientific element to it. It has to have some sort of ring of this could be true. And especially for, you know, folks in the 1950s, you know, the average teenager in America in the 1950s, they thought, wow, a creature could be living in the Amazon. You know, this could be possible. So
there could be a link between fish and man.
Yes, for sure. So she went and did research into Devonian age fossils and fish and reptiles. And she really wanted to give this design a ring of truth. And so she sketched out the creature, those designs of which have been either lost to time or I have a theory that the creature designs are either in some collector's home and they are not, they're refusing to tell anyone that they have them, or they are in somebody's box in a garage full of old VHSs somewhere, I think.
And they don't know they have them.
Yes. I like to think that they exist somewhere in the world. That is my hope, but currently no one has ever really seen them. And, you know, back then people didn't scan things and put them online for prosperity. So we just have never been able to see those full designs. But from Millicent's sketches, they worked and started making a models and then molds, and then it was realized into a full suit.
And then Universal sent Millicent Patrick around the country.
Yes. So what happened was after the movie was completed and they realized, and it was starting to get very, like the test audiences loved it. Everybody loved it. They started to realize that they had a hit on their hands. They were trying to come up with ways to promote it. And they thought, wow, you know, we have this beautiful woman who is an actress and a model who designed it. Why don't we send her around the country with some of the rest of our monsters and have her promote it? Because the funny thing about this period of time in Universal history is now the Universal monsters are such a, it's a, you know, household name. And you think, as soon as you say Universal monsters, you start thinking of them all, Frankenstein's monster and Dracula and the Wolfman. But at that point, Universal, right before they gave in and they decided to get into science fiction films, they kind of wanted to put that behind them. They really wanted to make serious movies. They wanted to make dramas and action films. They didn't want to be associated with their past of creating these genre films and these monsters. But once they had such a big hit with the science fiction films and they knew that creature was gonna go well, they thought, you know, let's embrace it. Let's lean into our monster heritage. Let's bring all these old monster designs out of the vault. And they wanted to have Millicent capitalize on that. So they thought, all right, well, we can send her around with all these designs of Frankenstein's monster and all this cool stuff. And it'll be great publicity. The problem, of course, with all of that was Millicent's boss, Bud Westmore, who was a notorious Westmore brother. The Westmores were a dynasty in Hollywood makeup at the time. They were extremely influential and had a lot of power and a lot of sway in Hollywood. And problem is, Bud Westmore was a beauty makeup designer. He was not a monster person. That's why he needed Millicent so badly. But he was very sore about that, and especially since his predecessor was the famous Jack Pierce at Universal, and he was probably pretty threatened by the fact that they were bringing Jack Pierce's old incredible designs out to promote this film, The Creature from the Black Lagoon, and he didn't want people to know that he didn't design it. Because back then, today, when we watch a film, we're used to seeing a 10-minute long end crawl with every single person possible who worked on the film getting credited. But back then, that wasn't the case. It was only the heads of department that got credit for things. So Bud Westmore got credit for everybody in his makeup department. It was just said Bud Westmore. So people assumed that everything, all the movies that he worked on, all the movies that Universal did, he made those designs. But that's not true. And he was very uncomfortable with the idea that this beautiful, talented woman, the first woman to ever do the work that she did, the first woman to ever work in a makeup department at a movie studio, was going to go around the country telling everybody that he didn't design this monster. And that was absolutely unacceptable to him. And he tried to stop the tour.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. And we are talking this week with Mallory O'Mara. She's a film producer, and she has written a fabulous film history book called The Lady from the Black Lagoon, Hollywood Monsters, and the Lost Legacy of Millicent Patrick. Millicent Patrick was an animator who worked for the Walt Disney Studios. Her father had been one of the engineers who worked at William Randolph Hearst's castle in San Simeon. And so Millicent Patrick, as a little girl, had grown up on the grounds of the castle before going to art school, becoming an animator at Disney, and then an actress at Universal Studios, which eventually led her to the makeup department, where she worked under Bud Westmore and designed the creature from the Black Lagoon, a character featured in the movie The Creature from the Black Lagoon, made in 1955. And before the break, Mallory O'Meara was telling us that Millicent Patrick toured the country as a representative of Bud Westmore's makeup department. She didn't take credit for the creature that she had designed. But nevertheless, Bud Westmore was infuriated that this beautiful woman was touring the country, taking credit for his work, which, of course, was not the case since it wasn't his work and she wasn't taking credit for it. Mallory O'Meara, tell us, was Bud Westmore upset that Millicent Patrick was this beautiful woman who was touring the country on a publicity tour? Or was he upset just because Millicent Patrick was not him?
It was sort of both. It all kind of mashed together into one big rage fit for him. Because there was definitely a part of it that she was a woman. The language that they used around her tour was pretty rough. You know, they were afraid that she was going to, quote, you know, go off the deep end, and she needed to be chaperoned everywhere that she went. Every interview that she did, she needed to be chaperoned so she said the right thing. But it was also, again, that he didn't do this and he didn't want anybody to know. So, and it was this woman who was standing up and saying that he didn't. So, I would say that it was a perfect storm of things for him.
Now, what in your book, you mentioned this, but were there other people who had complained over the years about Bud Westmore being a credit hog?
Yes. He had sort of a bad reputation. He was notorious for this. So there was all kinds of funny anecdotes about how, you know, he would be in his office doing administrative work, and then reporters or photographers would come in and he would rush into the makeup studio and grab a paintbrush and pose over some design to look as if he was doing those things. There were other people who had been fired by him, and he had a kind of a reputation that if an artist working under him in the makeup department started getting a lot of, you know, good designs and talent and started outshining him, as he would find a way to either give them the cold shoulder and push them out or fire them, or they have them quit. He was really not a great tempered person, but he was very influential and had a lot of power. So it was a sort of a situation that was doomed to explode at some point.
And this move by Westmore stifled Millicent Patrick's career forever. She didn't just go to a different studio or get past it. That was it for her as a designer of makeup and monsters.
Yeah, yes, that's true. Although I won't spoil what it is in the book, but he did end up using some of her designs to create another very famous science fiction film. The monster design for that one. But after that, she dropped off the map. Nobody knew. Most people, unless you were a hardcore Creature from the Black Lagoon nerd, you didn't know who Millicent Patrick was.
Now, Mallory O'Meara, you said in your book that you had to kind of forgive Millicent Patrick. You wanted her to do more. You wanted her to strike back.
Yeah, I think a lot of and that urge comes from, you know, this desire that we all have and this fantasy that we all have that if someone did us wrong, we would do something about it. You know, we would make a stink. It wouldn't happen to us. But the truth is, what could she have done? You know, there was no Twitter for her to call him out on back then. There was this man had all the power and influence in Hollywood and could sort of do whatever he wanted. And if he said, you know, wanted to do something, there wasn't a lot of options for her. And at first I was really angry. I wanted her to, like, you know, throw him into the sea, you know, get in a big fight, make a big stink. But there wasn't anything that she could have done. And I think that, you know, especially in this sort of Me Too era that we're living in, there's so many of this backlash. Well, why didn't you say anything? Why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do this? And it's weird that we put the onus of reparations and fixing a situation on the people who have been done wrong. You know, it was bad enough that Millicent did this incredible thing, got it taken away from her, and then she has to fight to get it back. Like, when does she get to have a rest? Like, why couldn't literally anybody else fight for her? And the good thing is some people did. There was a publicity team at Universal that sort of pushed back and said, hey, bud, you didn't do this. This isn't right. But they were overruled, and nobody knew who Millicent Patrick was for 60 years.
And even when you started to do research on your book, The Lady from the Black Lagoon, you found that Universal horror enthusiasts didn't even believe you when you said that Millicent Patrick had designed the creature.
That's true. This might be the first book that got hate mail before it even came out. there was a lot of people who were very, very, very reluctant to believe that this woman had done this design. I had gotten a lot of fans and film historians emailing me, telling me that Millicent Patrick, you know, didn't belong on that set, or she didn't do this design, or I'm trying to remember the exact phrasing. Oh, someone had said that there was a mythology that had developed around Millicent Patrick because she was a woman, which is so funny because no other woman had done what she had done. Men have literally everybody else in all of history. They couldn't even let this one woman have her day. And there were some people who said that she was only on that set because she was somebody's girlfriend. You know, it's just absolutely bonkers. All the excuses that were given, the people bending themselves in knots rather than just admitting the obvious, the Occam's razor is that Millicent Patrick just designed that monster.
And so you're a film producer. How did you get into film yourself?
I actually got into film in a strange way. I did not go to film school, but I met my current boss at a horror convention in New England that I was volunteering at, and we got along really, really well. And he had just started this company and really needed someone to work on social media for him. And I was working at a veterinary clinic at the time, but I did a lot of horror things, but all volunteer stuff. I ran a book club. I helped at conventions. I was just very involved in the fandom. And I thought, you know what? Screw it. I'll take this big life change leap and give it a shot. And I quit my job and I started working for Dark Dunes Productions, which I still work for 7 years later. And I'm so, so glad.
So now, wait a minute. You worked in a veterinary clinic? And you're also obsessed with Iceland. Do you ride horses?
Iceland?
Yeah. I heard on one of your podcasts that you were obsessed with Iceland.
Yeah, I love Iceland because Iceland has this incredible culture of reading.
That's true.
They're a culture that really, really loves to read, and I also really love to read. I host a weekly podcast with my friend, writer and filmmaker Bria Grant, and we're just huge, huge readers. And Iceland, even though books are wildly expensive there because everything needs to be imported, They are a very big reading culture, and I love them.
Have you been to Iceland?
I actually have. Yeah, I went there in the winter of 2017, 2018, mm-hmm. And it was wonderful. I had a really, really great time there.
Yeah, I love Iceland too. And but I was just wondering because, you know, the Icelandic horses are the greatest.
Oh, no. I actually, I worked at a small animal practice. I've never worked with large animals, even though if I had more time, if I was an immortal person, I would certainly go back to college for zoology. And I would definitely want to keep working with animals. It's hard to have a bad day when you work with animals.
What's this deal where we only get one lifetime? That doesn't seem right.
I know. Well, you know what? I'm sure Elon Musk is working on it somewhere.
Well, tell us, Mallory O'Meara, you have a new book that's coming out soon.
I do. I am working on a book right now called Girly Drinks. It is the history of women making and drinking alcohol all over the world from the time when alcohol was discovered / invented until now. It is probably the most fun book to research that I will ever write in my career. Although it is tough right now. Being a nonfiction writer during the pandemic is a tough, tough thing. But it is absolutely wonderful. It's telling the story of women who drink, who make alcohol, who distill, who brew, from, you know, Mesopotamia till today.
Well, maybe when that book comes out, you'll come back and talk to us again.
I would absolutely love to. I am very excited, and we'll see what this new world of book releasing in the pandemic will look like.
Well, I hope it ends. I really want it to end. But the book that we've been talking about and that I want everybody to read is called The Lady from the Black Lagoon, Hollywood Monsters and the Lost Legacy of Millicent Patrick. And the author, the brilliant Mallory O'Meara, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much for having me. I had a blast.
Mallory O'Meara, the book, The Lady from the Black Lagoon, Hollywood Monsters and the Lost Legacy of Millicent Patrick. Every other Wednesday, I get to drop by KSCO's morning program, Good Morning Monterey Bay, and talk books with the host, Rosemary. Here's one of my recent visits.
Every other Wednesday morning, we have a conversation with Gary Shapiro. Gary is the host of From the Bookshelf, Mondays at 7 p.m. here on KSCO, where he has author interviews, often in relation to the books that we talk about on this segment of the program. And he joins us. Hi, Gary. Good morning.
Good morning. Nice to be with you.
And good to have you here with us this morning. What is our theme today?
Well, I read a couple of memoirs this week, and one I think you'll really like a lot is called Jennifer Juniper.
Oh, yes. Jennifer
Beyond the Muse.
Juniper, yes.
That's right. And it's written by the subject of that song, Jenny Boyd. She's from your old home place. She's British, and she was the wife of Mick Fleetwood. They were married twice.
Oh.
If you were going to write a novel about the 60s and 70s, and you picked as your character a beautiful girl who was everywhere anything groovy happened in the 60s, people wouldn't believe your novel. They wouldn't take, you know, they just wouldn't take your character seriously. But Jenny Boyd did all those things. She was a London, swinging London model in the 60s, and she was a guest, you know, like one of the girls dancing on Ready, Steady, Go.
Oh, gosh.
And then her sister, Patty Boyd, was cast in a movie called A Hard Day's Night. And she ended up being married to George Harrison and then later being married to Eric Clapton. So Jenny Boyd, sister-in-law of both of them. And then when they all went to India, when Patty and George and the Beatles went to India, to Rishikesh, to study with the Maharishi, Jenny went along with them, and she learned transcendental meditation with the gang. She went to San Francisco for the Summer of Love in 1967. She was at the Monterey Pop Festival. And then she married Mick Fleetwood and was part of the whole 70s L.A. cocaine-fueled rock scene. So she was really everywhere. It's a
boy.
Yeah, a really good book. Jennifer Juniper, A Journey Beyond the Muse.
And that was that the song by Donovan?
Yeah, Donovan wrote the song for her. And I asked her I spoke to her the other day. I said, what was it like, you know, to sit there and have Donovan play you this song that he wrote for you? And she said, you know, it was marvelous. It's wonderful. She liked Donovan a lot, and she'd met him a few times. And he said, you know, come here into my room and sit down. I want to play you this song. And, you know, she realized it was about her. And then the line comes, you know, what would it be like if she loved me? And,
mm-hmm.
and Jenny was like, well, you know, I don't really want to get into any kind of a relationship with Donovan. I mean, I like him, but... She's a little uncomfortable, but
really, that's very interesting.
Yeah. Oh, you'd love that book, Rosie. It's really good.
I mean, what a life that is. Well, boy, talk about a foot in every door.
Yeah. Anytime anything interesting happens, he was there. And that, you know, she met Mick Fleetwood, 16 years old. He wasn't a star in Fleetwood Mac. He was a kid, played the drums. And so she knew him, you know, long before he was famous. And then, you know, she was married to him when they went to L.A. and ended up joining forces with Buckingham Nicks and becoming this incredible billion-dollar band. You know, so she had been with him as a struggling musician and then with him as, you know, an international success.
Good, that's great.
Oh, pretty interesting. And then, you know, then not only that, but then after all of that, she went to school, got a PhD, became a counselor for people in treatment for recovery from drugs and alcohol. She's a really brilliant woman, and she wrote a really good book. No co-author, no ghostwriter. She actually wrote it.
Good for her. Gosh, that's great.
Fantastic. And then I read this other memoir by a woman named Melody Thomas Scott. Now, she has been a stripper. She's committed murder. She had venereal disease. She was kidnapped. She was married several times. She'd been to rehab. She escaped from rehab. She went to prison for a little while. She'd been seriously ill several times. She died a couple of times. And all of these things she did as Nikki on the daytime drama The Young and the Restless. The book is called Always Young and Restless, My Life on and Off America's Number One Daytime Drama, Melody Thomas Scott.
Wow.
So, she's a really, she actually wrote a really good book as well, which is just coming out. And I don't know if you're a fan of daytime drama. Probably not, because you're on the radio when they're on.
Yes, no, I've never watched any of the soaps.
But The Young and the Restless is still on. You know, a lot of them are gone now. And Melody Scott Thomas points out that, Melody Thomas Scott points out that it was the O.J. Simpson trial that really changed people's habits and spelled the end of daytime drama. You know, there used to be tons of them on the air every day. Now there's only a couple. And she said it was the O.J. Simpson trial. When that went on for a year, people were into that, and they got out of the habit of watching soaps.
Really? Isn't that interesting? Because of the trial?
Yeah, because of O.J. And she said they were all watching it too, you know, but they thought, well, everybody will come back to the soaps afterwards, but they didn't.
Well, but really the soaps are different now. It's the Real Housewives of this, that, and the other that I've never seen either, but I think those have sort of replaced a lot of them. And then daytime talk shows, of course, as well.
Yes, well, of course, there were always those, but O.J. had something to do with that. That is, people were suddenly drawn to reality TV. There wasn't a lot of reality TV before the O.J. Simpson trial. And there was a lot of reality TV after that. It was very interesting. But in addition to being a star on the soaps, she started as a kid. Her first movie was when she was like 8 or 9 years old. And she played Marnie as a child in Alfred Hitchcock's movie Marnie with Tippi Hedren.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so she was Tippi Hedren as a little girl. And she was also in The Shootist with John Wayne. That was his last movie. And she has a scene with him toward the end of the movie. She is the last actress to appear on screen with John Wayne.
Huh.
Strange. And she was in The Beguiled and Dirty Harry with Clint Eastwood. She was in The Fury with John Cassavetes. So she did quite a few movies before becoming the star of this show. And she's been on the show for 40 years.
Has she won an Emmy yet?
I don't know if she won an Emmy, but she has, you know, except she's never had an evil twin. But other than that, everything that happens on the soaps to those people, you know, soap operas are kind of bizarre. She lives in her character lives in a town called Genoa City, which just like Pine Valley and all the other towns in soap operas, it has an international airport, but only one diner.
Well, they've never really tried to be reality, have they? I mean, they're just sort of, they're on the periphery of a reality, shall we say.
Yeah, and you know, since they're in your home every day, everybody thinks, you know, they know you. And so people are always approaching her. And she tries to be very nice, but sometimes she's just not in the mood. And one time she said several years ago, she stopped to get her newspapers and magazines on the way home at a newsstand. In those days, you had to buy news. You couldn't just click it on your phone. And she just wasn't really in the mood. And a woman approached her and said, "Aren't you Nikki?" And she said, "Yes, yes, I am. You know, like, leave me alone." And the woman said, "Oh, I'm a big fan of yours. I'm Aretha Franklin." Huh. And she was like, oh, my God, I'm being true to Aretha Franklin. And then years later, they were at a Grammy Awards together, and she was praying that Aretha wouldn't remember. And Melody said, oh, it's so wonderful to meet you. I'm such a big fan. She goes, I remember the news, Stan.
That's hilarious. Gosh, you just never know what's going to be around the corner, do you?
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.